You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
How do, friends? Welcome to the program. What was the weather like where you are today? Wow, we had a torrential deluge. It was biblical. It was absolutely end of days kind of a downpour. But of course, I don't know where you are, but we needed it in a big, big way. And it must have rained for four straight hours up in Thornhill, Old Thornhill, where I reside these days. And the mighty Aphrodite remains over in the old country in Greece, coming home Monday, picking her up at the airport. It's been 3 weeks. Man, I miss her. I miss her. And the little guys, of course, miss her too. Spent the weekend. Saturday was just a scorcher. So I said, I can't have 5.5-year-old twins running around in the house all day. It was, I thought it was just too hot for them to be running outside. So I went and I went to Canadian Tire, which is our Walmart, for those of you listening stateside. And I, not quite, sort of. Anyway, I went to Canadian Tire and I bought the little guys a wading pool. This was a huge wading pool. Something like 12 feet in diameter and 36 inches high. And so, of course, I take this thing out, spent, I don't know, $129. But that doesn't matter. You know, it's hot. The boys got to cool off. So I unfurled this thing, and much bigger than I thought, dragged it out to the backyard, tried to find a level spot. And it turns out there's an inflatable ring around the pool that you've got to blow up. And took out the old hand pump, and standing there in 105 degrees, just giving her with this hand pump, and I must have pumped an hour and barely made a dent in this thing. Finally, about 2 hours later, I had the outer ring inflated, and then, of course, you start to fill the pool with the water. Meanwhile, the boys are standing there in their swimming suits saying, "Is it ready yet? Is it ready yet?" 3 hours later, they're in the water, splashing around, having a great old time, and, of course, I am spent for the day. Anyway, a good time was had by all. So I hope you're keeping cool wherever you are, and we've got a cool one for you tonight, as always. A couple of years ago, I'm down at the Toronto, the Canadian National Exhibition, the big CNE, the grand old lady by the lake, and I was doing a remote broadcast for another radio station, producing a talk show, and a couple of these teenagers were sort of hanging around the mobile unit, big. Like an RV, and they were dressed, how shall I say, in that goth uniform, you know, complete with the black fingernails and the black eyeshadow, and they kind of waved me over because they knew I did this the weekend show at the station, talking about what I talk about now, and they had something to get off their chest, and they told me about this experience they'd had with a Ouija board. And I don't know if they were pulling my leg. They seemed pretty legit. They seemed quite frightened, actually. They told me that a couple of years ago prior, they had bought a Ouija board. They took it home. They thought the spirit world. They didn't like the message that came through, so they went out and they threw the Ouija board out. They just threw it out. And about a week later, one of them opens up a closet, and there it is sitting in the closet again. So they, once again, they take the Ouija board. This time they walk it across the street. There's a shopping mall with one of those great big garbage bins out back. They tossed it in that. They figured, okay, that's it. It's gone. Again, a week later, somebody opens up the closet. There it is. They could not throw this Ouija board away. So finally, they got online. They went on the internet, and they found out the proper disposal procedure for a Ouija board, which is apparently, I think, you burn it or something. Anyway, yes, they threw it into the fire, and that was the end of that. But and they learned their lesson. Can you imagine throwing the Ouija board out, and then you find it comes back to you again and again? Well, we're going to talk about Ouija boards tonight, or talking boards, as they used to be called. Now, of course, it's like Kleenex, right? It's a brand name, but that's the only name that you call tissues, Kleenex. Well, Ouija boards, that was one brand of talking boards. Now we call them all Ouija boards. We're going to get into Ouija boards. And who more credentialed than my next guest to discuss this? She joins us frequently on the program. Tonight we get her for the full hour, and I'm delighted. She's the author of more than 50 books on paranormal and metaphysical subjects. Her latest is Ouija Gone Wild, Shocking True Stories. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, welcome to The Conspiracy Show once again. How are you?
I'm doing great, Richard. And we have such a fantastic topic tonight. I can't wait to get into it.
Well, it is a fantastic topic. I'm concerned about the proliferation of Ouija boards, how people tend to use them as toys, and we'll talk about that. I can't believe that they're being marketed at young people in popular toy stores for children, in fact. I've seen them there. But let's go back and talk about the history of the Ouija board. For those people who've never even heard of them, and as hard as that may be to imagine, there may be some. They used to be called talking boards. What is a talking board exactly?
That's the generic term. And as you pointed out, Ouija is a trademark name, and it's become kind of a generic term. But it's a board made out of wood or cardboard or some other material that has each letter of the alphabet on it, the numerals 1 through 9 plus 0, and sometimes some of the words like yes and no, goodbye, kind of a shorthand like that for getting answer, yes or no answers to questions. And then it has a device which is called a pointer or a planchette, which is used to move around the board. And the idea behind the talking board is that you place your fingers lightly on the pointer or planchette, as it's called, ask spirits to answer a question, and then allow the spirits to theoretically move the pointer through your hands to spell out messages and to give numbers and to say yes or no. These devices have been in various forms for a long time. Human beings have used divinations for centuries, even millennia, to consult spirits for answers. The Ouija board itself, in the form that most people know it when they go to the store and buy a board, that's been around since 1892.
Wow. And do these things work? I mean, obviously, there is the potential for manipulation if one of the people who has their fingers on the planchette decides that they're, going to move it around wherever they want rather than letting the spirit move them. I mean, how can you sort of verify that the message coming through is not being manipulated by someone in the room?
It's always tricky with different kinds of spirit communications, evaluating the response. And yes, certainly I think there are cases where people subconsciously move the planchette. They anticipate an answer or even in the back of their mind there's an answer they'd like to get. It's very hard to rule those cases out. But yet we have so many cases where it's harder to explain away, where the planchette seems to take on a life of its own and literally zoom around the board so fast you can hardly keep your fingers on it. I've had cases like that where I know I'm not moving it, and I know the other person that I'm working with, usually two people put their hands on the pointer. You wonder what's going on because the planchette seems to be operating through some other invisible external force. And yes, people do get accurate answers to questions, information that can be validated. And then there are other communications where things are just totally off and people are given erroneous information that often influences them to do crazy and bizarre things and even commit crimes. The Ouija board has a very strange history.
Rosemary Ellen Guiley is with us. The book is Ouija Gone Wild, Shocking True Stories. We should say the book was written with Rick Fisher. Now, how do you, or who are you communicating with? Do you have a clearer idea now than when you first started to research this? I mean, are you communicating with the souls of the departed on some spiritual plane? Are you perhaps being deceived, and are you communicating with demons? Who are you talking to?
I think all of the above, Richard. There are cases where people have gotten validated information that they've sought from people who've passed on. They want to communicate with a dead loved one, for example, and they get information that only they and certain family members would know, or that would be very particular to that that dead person. Other people seem to have been in contact with spiritual guides, and they've channeled literary works, fictional works, inspired spiritual wisdom, starting with the Ouija board and then usually advancing to some other form of spirit communication that's a little faster than spelling things out letter by letter. Then there are these dark messages that seem to come from trickster spirits. They start out very friendly and good, and then once a person's trust has been gained, the messages get very dark and threatening, and people often start to have problems at home with nightmares and visitations and very unpleasant paranormal phenomena. So these seem to be more of a demonic nature. All spirit communications have the potential to go awry. There's nothing inherently bad about spirit communications or bad about talking boards. People can have all kinds of experiences, but it seems there are a lot of tricksters out there who like to get involved and turn things topsy-turvy.
Have you had a particularly harrowing experience with a Ouija board? I'm guessing that you've been involved with or have used Ouija boards on countless occasions. Can you share a story with me of an incident where your Ouija board went wild?
I've had several experiences where communications have kind of gone unexpected and also taken a negative turn. I haven't had any as horrific as some of the ones that we describe in the book, fortunately, where people have been plagued in the home environment after a session has been over. But in one particular case, this was in Salem, and I was with a group of friends staying in a haunted house, and we invited one of the well-known Salem warlocks, Christian Day, who's very mediumistic, to come and do a seance with us. And he brought his own Ouija board and a genuine human skull that he uses also as a tool for contacting spirits. And Christian and I worked the Ouija board together, and we got some communication where the communicator identified herself as a little girl who had lived in the house. This was a house that went back to colonial days.
Rosemary, let me interject here. We're going to pick up this story on the other side. The music is welling up underneath us, so when we come back, we'll find out about this Ouija board incident in Salem. And this is starting to get creepy already. We'll be back with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, paranormal researcher. Don't go away.
Loose lips sink ships, and sometimes corporations. Got something to say? Call Richard Serrett now at 416-360-0740. Or toll free in Ontario, 1-866-740-4740.
Wow, what was that music coming back? David, that was frightening. There's the soundtrack for your summer. That certainly wasn't the Beach Boys, folks, let me tell you. Rosemary Ellen Guiley is with us, a paranormal researcher. And again, over 50 books to her credit. She investigates haunted places, entity contact experiences, UFOs, mysterious creatures, spirit communication, and more. Spirit communication, that's what we're on about tonight with her new book, brand new book, Ouija Gone Wild, Shocking True Stories. Let's get back to Salem, Massachusetts, and you're there with the number one warlock, I guess, in them their parts, and you're about to sit down to a Ouija board.
Well, the pointer started moving very rapidly, and this was one of those cases where I could hardly keep my fingers on the pointer as it zipped around. And the communicator identified itself as a little girl who said she had lived in the house. Now, we didn't have the exact history of all the occupants of the home. We were renting it. It did go back to colonial days, so there were probably many little girls who lived in the house. And while this pointer was zipping around on the board, we started hearing these bangings and thumpings on the walls, like something was inside the walls pounding in the room. And these bangings went all the way around the room. So some of the participants got rather spooked by all of this, and we're doing it at night, of course. This is often what happens to people is there are manifestations of phenomena, and they can be quite unsettling to some people. But what happened then with us is typical of many sessions as well. The communication begins to disintegrate, and instead of getting coherent words, you start to get gibberish. And after a while, nothing makes sense, and the energy either winds down or you just lose patience with it and end the session. And that's what happened with us. So sessions often start out good, and an energy builds and things manifest, and then things sort of unexpectedly dissolve. Many people still remain unsettled by that, and I think this is where some of their problems come in. They get spooked by the phenomena. They can't get it out of their heads. They keep thinking about it over and over again, and they become susceptible to a lot of things that might be lingering in the psychic atmosphere, so to speak. Another communicator that I have experienced periodically is an entity who calls itself Zaza, Z-A-Z-A, and this seems to be a variation of a communicator who is also known as Zozo. And this is a very negative, nasty entity who has shown up literally hundreds of times. And that's all, you know, it may even be more than that, but just documented cases. And again, as disguised as someone friendly with helpful information and maybe even nice and entertaining, and then as the sessions go on, unmask itself as a very threatening entity and makes dire predictions like somebody's going to die, the entity's going to get the people who are using the board, and things like that.
Well, once you use a Ouija board, if you use it just once, and let's say Zaza or Zozo shows up, or you know, makes themselves known, have you essentially opened a portal? Is that like an invitation, and now they can walk through anytime they want?
Well, anytime you engage in spirit communications, whether you're using a board, a Frank's box, dowsing rods, even automatic writing, or mediumship, you are opening a doorway to the spirit world and inviting something to come through that doorway and interact with you. When the session is closed, that usually ends the opening, and you no longer have a link to anything that you've connected with. But in some cases, and a lot of it depends on the individuals and the environment and sometimes subconscious fears or anxieties people bring to any spirit communications, the link is never completely shut off. And spirits seem to have continuing access to a person. They can attach in some ways. And the attachments might be temporary. They might go away after a while. In some cases, they can be quite persistent, and people start having ongoing psychic attack problems. And Rick and I document some of those, especially with the Zozo phenomenon in the book.
All right. When I opened the show, I was talking about these young goths who came up to me and told me about their misadventure with the Ouija board. Again, I don't know that they were they weren't pulling my leg, although they seemed frightened when they were retelling the story. And they couldn't get rid of the Ouija board. They threw it out. It came back to them. Have you heard stories similar to this?
Many times, and from many independent sources. So it's hard to ignore because I have encountered it so frequently over the years. Spirits do have the ability to move objects around, and I've had this happen to me in the course of my investigations. I've had things disappear and reappear. I've had objects I didn't even own appear, and it gets very hard to explain them away naturally. And in fact, I even have a small collection of Ouija boards. I've got about 7 or 8 of them, and the oldest one goes back to the 1960s. It's not real old. But one of the older ones I call my haunted board because its pointer went missing for a couple of years and then mysteriously reappeared in the box. And I have absolutely no explanation for how that happened. So I can lend credence to some of these stories about trying to dispose of a board and not being able to. Now, the thing about burning boards, some of the older boards were made out of masonite, which is very resistant to burning, and that may be the case for stories about, you know, it was a demon board because I couldn't get it to burn, you know, that sort of angle. And by the way, it's been Hollywood that has really promoted the whole demon angle. The board really was considered an entertainment device for decades and decades. But other people have tried to dispose of it. They've thrown it away into garbage. They've even broken it into pieces and thrown it away. The pieces show up again. Very mysterious what happens there. And so the occult explanation would be the spirits bring it back.
Let's talk about the Ouija board's involvement in particular murder cases.
There have been some very strange ones over the decades, cases where people have been incited to commit murder or attempt to commit murder because the Ouija board told them to, that someone needed to die. There have been cases where spouses have asked the spirits on the board if they're... spouse is cheating on them. They get a yes answer, so it enrages them, and they attempt homicide. We have cases of jury members consulting Ouija boards about whether or not somebody is guilty. Now, that's a very scary thought to me.
It is, and hopefully grounds for a mistrial.
They're not being reported.
Yeah, I'm hoping that's grounds for a mistrial.
There was a very strange case in America in the 1930s where a woman thought her husband was having an affair with her neighbor, and the spirit said, yes, he is, and he's promised to give her all this money. So she and her daughter tie him up in the basement and torture him.
Oh, my.
Beat him up and subject him to a shock with electrical wires and to try and get him to confess that he's having this affair. And he denies it. The man evidently was not having an affair. And he managed to escape. They caught him, brought him back to the basement, start torturing him again. And he was able to break free, and this time he was enraged, and he killed his wife. So he was charged with homicide. And in the trial, all of this came out and about the Ouija board, and he was acquitted. It was ruled that he was justified in his actions. So here's sort of the twisted turn on the case is that she gets erroneous information about him and attempts to kill him, and he winds up killing her in the process. That's one of the strangest cases on record.
Oh, my. Now, has a Ouija board ever been used to solve a crime?
Yes. in the early part of the 20th century, there were cases reported in the news about information being obtained on Ouija boards that would help find missing people, missing objects, stolen property, and even murder cases. But whether or not that evidence was ever really admissible as such in court, that remains a much more murky situation. But at least the information gave leads that did lead to the solving of some crimes. When the Ouija board came out in 1892, it was marketed as an entertainment device, as a way to contact spirits. People didn't have to go and consult professional mediums. They had the power of being a medium right at home, and many people started using them. There was a lot of publicity about the board, and it was a novelty, and that propelled it into the headlines. So we have a lot of these strange cases. But I'll bet you today nobody would want to admit that they were using a Ouija board to solve a crime, because so many people think the board is a problematic device. And that's really an erroneous image that has unfortunately gotten into pop culture through what I call the demonization of the board in film and fiction.
But I mean that. But that risk is certainly there. I mean, as we've discussed.
Well, it certainly is, Richard. And this is a part of the peculiar history of the Ouija board. One of the reasons why Rick and I wanted to do this book is we thought the board really had gotten in recent years an unfair rap, with people associating it with bad things and bad entities, when overall, if you look at the whole history of the board, it's really not so. But it does have this dark underbelly to it, and that could very well be the way it's been used by people, the things they approach it for. And also, I think in many of these cases where crimes have been committed or people have entered into legal things that were bad for them or divorced people and whatever because the board told them to, it may very well be that they're inclined to do something anyway and they're looking for any sort of validation to give them permission to do so.
There's a couple of instances you cite in the book, Ouija Gone Wild, in which the board was used to locate missing persons. There was a case of Walter Moriarty back in 1920. Deserted his wife, two children.
Deserted his wife, and the Ouija board told her where to find him. Now, in some of these cases, the board is right, and in others, it winds up being kind of a dead end. But it's very peculiar where the board says, yes, you can find him in such and such a place. And I think she went to the police and enlisted their help as well. There are several cases like that. Details of the Moriarty case escape me at the moment.
Yeah, no, it was it's just a very small entry here, but he was in New York, according to the Ouija board. Mrs. Moriarty remembered her husband had friends in New York. Police in New York were asked to investigate, and they found and arrested Mr. Moriarty right where Ouija said he would be.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, and there have been other cases where the Ouija board has said, well, you can find the person in such and such a place. And it winds up being a dead end. But in that case, it was right on. So what gives here, where nobody really knew where the man was? And so where did this information come from? Was it a helpful spirit? Was it some sort of, data bank in the cosmos? It's very hard to explain these things away as manipulation and imagination.
Indeed. When we come back, let's talk about Grace Kelly, who is very interested in Ouija boards, and we'll also find out the mystery of Aurob. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, paranormal researcher, discussing Ouija Gone Wild, shocking true stories. We'll get yours as well. Phone lines available to you. Stay tuned for the numbers. Back with more. Don't go away.
Poking Holes in the Darkness. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740. To see the light, call Richard now
at 416-360-0740 or toll-free in Ontario at 1-866-740-4740.
And if you have an experience with a Ouija board, we'd love to hear from you. It can be a negative experience, a positive experience. Welcome back. Richard Serrett with you here on The Conspiracy Show. Rosemary Allen Guiley is with us. Ouija Gone Wild, Shocking True Stories. The book is written with Rick Fisher. And as you point out in the book, Rosemary, many of the early history cases of the Ouija board were collected by Rick. As a result of his own Ouija experiences. Now, back in 97, he had contact with a spirit claiming to be a Native American, and this communicator gave the unlikely Indian name of Orop. Tell us about this.
Orop was a woman who said she had lived between 1784 and 1840. And some of the details that she offered about herself seemed to make sense. That is, she sort of corroborated herself. She didn't give contradictory information. And she said she had lived in a place called Chickies. Now, Rick lives in central Pennsylvania. He's a longtime paranormal investigator. And we've worked together on many projects. And Rick had never heard of Chickies Rock. But it turned out to be a very real place and had quite a bit of Native American lore associated with it, and also a lot of haunting lore. It's a big bluff over the Susquehanna River. And she said she had lived there, and she had two children, and talked in some detail about her diet and her lifestyle with very strange spellings. There were a lot of O-P's in her word and words, and her name even being Orop, a very unlikely Native American name. But that's the case with the Ouija board communications, that they seem to be very unusual sometimes, and there's no way to verify whether or not an Orop ever actually existed. But she gave the name of a place that turned out to be real that he had never heard of, and which became a very important site for his future investigations. Now, one day he asked her if she would actually show up for him. If he went to Chickies Rock, would she manifest in some way for him? And she said that he should bring her a flower as a gift, and she would bring him an arrowhead as a gift. So he went to Chickies Rock at the appointed time, and nothing happened, but he had forgotten to take the flower. So he gets back on the board when he gets home and says, he asked, oh, where was Arrowhead? You know, like, what happened to you? And the answer he got back was, where was flower?
Oh, my.
Now, when she decided to stop communicating with him, he felt very sorry. He was sad. He felt like he was getting to know someone who was on the other side or in some other dimension. She wanted to be reunited with her children, apparently, and seemed to be separated from them somehow in the afterlife. Well, Rick went on to have a lot of other communications with personalities, and some of them had stranger stories than others. Some seemed to be very what we would consider normal historical stories of people who lived in the past. But it's none of them came up with information that he could historically track down. And that doesn't mean that they aren't real. It just may mean that the records are unobtainable or don't exist. We just have no way of knowing.
All right. Now, I was just going to say we'll get to some phone calls here in a moment, but we're just going to get ready to take a time out. But I just wanted to tease a little bit about what's going to come up. I want to talk about Grace Kelly. She was a fan of the Ouija board. This was well known that she was involved in spirit communication. I didn't know that about her.
It got reported in the news media, and this was, well, it was surprising and not surprising because so many people considered the Ouija board entertainment, but she did like to use the Ouija board to ask about her horse betting. And this was reported in the entertainment news, and what wasn't reported was whether or not she ever won anything on the advice of the board.
Mm. And was Prince Rainier aware of this interest in the Ouija board?
He probably was. The one article that we were able to find about this didn't say what his opinion was, but she shared this interest with the wife of the actor Cary Grant. Her name was Betsy. And the two of them would get together and get their horse betting advice. And this was considered to be kind of silly entertainment. Cary Grant knew about it.
I'm gathering, though, that there was never any indication through the Ouija board to Grace Kelly about how she would die, or...
If there ever was, it was never reported. And there have been Ouija board cases, by the way, where deaths have been accurately predicted.
Well, we can touch on that when we come back. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Ouija Gone Wild, Shocking True Stories. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome back. Again, we're here with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and it's Ouija Gone Wild, Shocking True Stories. We'll get to yours right now, and we'll begin with David in Toronto. Hello, David. Welcome.
Hello, Mr. Serrett. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
I appreciate it. Welcome aboard.
Ms. Guiley, first little story about Ouija boards. Back in when I was in high school, which is years ago now, my buddy built his own. And he tried to contact his brother, who died by a drunk driver when he was 8 years old. When he was using it, a whole bunch of weird stuff started happening in the house. People were visibly shaken that attended that night. And he claimed to see shadow people after in the house. A spirit board or a talking board does open portals, but can they stay open first?
They might stay open depending upon how the board has been used and what is attracted to the particular session. And the big wild card is human consciousness. Some people are more mediumistic than others, and they've got kind of a natural portal almost all the time, which can be activated. And when you augment it with something like a session with a major tool, that can heighten the link. In Ouija Gone Wild, we have a whole chapter on shadow people. I had quite a few cases reported to me where people said pretty much the same thing. They had sessions that just sort of took a dark turn, and the shadow people manifested in the room both during the session and lingered afterward. And in some cases, people had a period of nightmares and disturbances, poltergeist effects, and some of them had to struggle to get past it and to close the door. In these particular cases, it may be the individuals themselves who are more vulnerable than other people to spirit attachment. And in the right environment and the right opportunity, something happens. Most people are going to use a spirit communications device and not have those kinds of issues.
All right, David, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, let's go next to Virginia in Niagara. Hello, Virginia. Welcome.
Hi. I want to talk about Ouija boards, but I must just tell you something first. My father's sister, my aunt, used to be a psychic for the British royal family of her time.
Ah, wow.
There was a lot of psychic in my family, and I've spoken with you before. I think you know about some of them.
Yes, yes. Well, it's not so well known that that Queen Victoria was...
It wasn't Queen Victoria.
No, I understand, but Queen Victoria was very interested in the spirit world.
Whole family, all the royals are.
Still to this day, amazing, interesting.
My story, after my father had just died, this man came up to me who I'd never met and asked me if we could talk. And I was dubious. And so we went to a couple of places. And then I took him to my apartment. And he lay on the floor, and he created a Ouija board. And he put it on, and we couldn't keep this. We had a glass upside down. We couldn't keep it on. It just went crazy and knocked everything flying. And he got cross, and he said, Virginia's father asked me to come to her, not the rest of you. Get lost. And he said to me, a lot of your friends have recently gone, and they've left you things, and you've got them all in this room, and they're all trying to get talking with you, and they're not working together. And I want to come with your father. And then it settled down, and he gave me some information about my father, which was very accurate, and I had to work on. But the funny part was he fell asleep, so I put a pillow under his head and a blanket around him and covered him tightly. And now the only way he can get out, we were several stories high, and the only way he can get out was through the door, and there was only a lock. It was an old lock, and I had to use the key inside and outside to get in. When I got up in the morning, he was gone, but it was as though he had just evaporated. The blankets were still there with the marks I put in them around him. He had just gone, and the door had not been opened.
My word.
And I asked several of my friends if they knew who he was, and nobody seemed to know. The other thing that amused me afterwards, when I thought about it, he never had anything to eat and drink. He always passed it to me to eat and drink.
Wow. What do you think that? So do you think that was a ghost, Virginia, that you'd invited in?
Could be. I really don't know. It was something that was very unusual, but I've had a lot of unusual things happen in my family, and we've discussed them.
We
and
have, indeed.
I think
indeed.
It was something that he maybe brought, sent over to communicate with me. I don't think it was of the earth.
Virginia, thank you for sharing that wonderful story. Remarkable.
Well, it sort of scared me a lot, but I'm not the scared sort. I've had a lot of phenomena happen.
Well, I look forward to you sharing some more in the future. What do you make of that, Rosemary?
It's very hard to come up with an explanation for a story like that. It's very unusual. There's just simply no explanation for it. There are manifestations of spirit where they seem to be real people, and they do interact with the living for a period of time, and then suddenly they're gone. They've fulfilled their purpose, and that's it.
You mentioned, or a previous caller, David, mentioned shadow people. What about the jinn? This is an area that, you are really on the forefront of researching into the vengeful jinn, the title of one of your more recent books. Are there cases where people have used a Ouija board and then reported having some sort of a genie or jinn infestation in their home?
There are entities that I think are jinn. Most people don't call them jinn because a lot of people in the West don't know what the jinn are or genies. But in the chapter that we have, Who Are the Communicators, we do discuss the presence of the jinn. And I am convinced that shadow people are a form that the jinn take when they want to come and cause human beings trouble. The trickster spirits who like to interfere, who like to be nice and then nasty, cause problems, and even manifest in the environment with poltergeist disturbances, are all characteristics of jinn. So some people might call them demons or astral spirits or evil spirits, they may be, in fact, jinn, who could be just having a joke on us to wanting to torment people.
What about Ouija boards or talking boards used for treasure hunting? I know you write about that in Ouija Gone Wild.
Well, there's a number of kinds of treasure hunting, and we have some cases in the book where the Ouija board told people where treasure was buried. And there was one case where two teenage girls went out into frigid conditions in the wintertime and disappeared because they were going to go find the treasure. Then we have another case of a man who was told where to dig for treasure. And he dug, and the earth collapsed in on him, and he was killed. Then we have the treasure hunting through the lottery. Will the Ouija board give winning lottery numbers? And we have cases where winning numbers are given in a couple of instances for small wins, and so people keep consulting the board and keep betting, and then the numbers go bad. They don't win out. In fact, Rick had one of those cases himself where, just for a lark, he asked for a pick three combination and got the numbers, didn't buy a ticket, and the numbers turned out to be the winning numbers. So he went and told his coworkers about it, and everybody got excited and wanted the Ouija board to predict the next pick three win, and they were all going to bet on it. So he got three more numbers, and the numbers didn't win. It was like, ha-ha, I had a joke on you.
Now, are there do's and don'ts for using a Ouija board? I mean, have you are you able to provide us with sort of a list of things that you shouldn't do when you're using a Ouija board and things that you should do?
Yes, we have a chapter and an appendix as well of tips for grounded use with a Ouija board. And some of them are just common sense things, like you shouldn't use one, you know, if you've had alcohol or any sort of recreational stimulant, so to speak. It's not a good idea because you're not very well grounded. If you're tired, if you're not in good health, if you're just trying to entertain yourself, and this is where a lot of young people, I think, make trouble for themselves, is they want to be entertained, they want to be scared, they do a lot of provoking, oh, let's see what you've got, you know, scare us, that sort of thing. And if you make contact with the spirit world, there are spirits who will oblige you. They will be happy to scare you. You'll get what you ask for. Any kind of spirit communication should be approached with common sense to ask for specific information or a specific contact. If things get out of hand, to be firm, to close the session. A lot of people bring anxiety and subconscious fear to any sort of spirit communication. And this is why I recommend that they not be used in paranormal investigation, simply because people have bizarre reactions themselves to the Ouija board. They're afraid of spirit communication, and that sort of atmosphere invites problems as well. Closing a session is very important. You end it. And instruct all the communicators to remain on their side, that they are not to stay in the physical environment. Another thing that people need to do is to shut their minds off about the session, not to go over it and over it in their heads, replay it constantly, think about it, especially if they've been a little frightened about it, because these sorts of things invite a continuing link.
If you've had a some sort of a nasty entity communicating with you through the Ouija board, what do you do? You stop the session immediately. How do you make sure that there's no further involvement with that entity?
How I handle that when that's come up, and it comes up in various kinds of spirit communications too, is I tell the entity to stop, to go away, that it's not welcome. And if it does not, then I end the session. And I just end it very firmly, and I instruct everything to go away, and I bring it to a close. And also that nothing is to stay, nothing is to linger in the environment or with any individual present. And then it's important to bring your own body energy field to a close as well, to shut down your consciousness, so to speak, to end that link.
Very quickly, Rosemary, final question. The proper disposal of an unwanted Ouija board?
Putting it in the garbage, throwing it in an incinerator, removing it from the premises is the best way to simply get rid of it.
If it comes back?
Do it over and over again, and if it keeps coming back, give it to find someone who's knowledgeable about the paranormal and objects that have spirit attachments to them, and hand it over to them.
Rosemary, thank you for Ouija Gone Wild, Shocking True Stories. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Richard. And don't forget my website, visionaryliving.com.
Excellent. Visionaryliving.com. So long.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. And don't forget my website, richardserrett.com.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740. Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the program, friends. In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by biblical prophecy expert Nils Hamerin. It's been a while since Nils has been on the program. He, the author of Seal of the End Times, and we'll do sort of a roundup of end times news, if you will. We'll examine some recent news events as seen through the prism of end times prophecy. Nils Hamerin coming up. But first, what we're going to do is just update you on a story we touched on last week. Well, touched on. We dedicated an hour to it. Recently, a former CIA official who acted as liaison to the entertainment industry, i.e. Hollywood and the motion picture industry, Chase Brandon, made some rather compelling public statements. He said that everything that we've heard, I'm paraphrasing, everything we've heard about the Roswell UFO crash in 1947, the U.S. Army covering up the recovery of an extraterrestrial craft and a recovery of alien bodies, everything we heard about that is absolutely 100% true. Chaz Brandon made these statements on the public airwaves, and I put together a panel of ufologists, including Victor Vigiani, who joins us on this program quite frequently, Robbie Graham, and my next guest, Grant Cameron, who, of course, has been doing some amazing UFO research with the various presidential libraries, uncovering documents through the Freedom of Information Act, and finding out, you know, how various White House administrations have been involved in the UFO issue. Grant Cameron, welcome to The Conspiracy Show once again.
Well, thanks for having me on, Richard, and I'm glad you're still following the story.
Well, we need to tie up some loose ends here, because too often when we talk about these stories, in this the 24-hour news cycle, we have these huge, you know, amazing stories, and then often we're left to wonder, well, whatever happened to that? Well, here we had one, Chase Brandon, a couple of weeks ago, talking about this, and then we discussed it on the program last week. You know, what did you make of Chase Brandon's comments? What did Robbie Graham, Victor Vigiani, and so forth? So you, Victor, and Robbie actually decided to contact the CIA. First of all, tell me how you communicated this to the CIA and remind us what you asked them.
Well, basically, it was a letter drafted by Robbie Graham, who's like Chase Brandon is sort of the media expert for the CIA. Robbie Graham is sort of the media expert for the UFO community. He drafted the letter. I was one of three signatories on the letter. And basically what we asked the CIA is to confirm that Chase Brandon was with him, with the agency. We asked how did he get on coast to coast? Was he given authorization to get on coast to coast? What was their reply, you know, their response? Where are the documents that he's talking about? All this kind of stuff. And basically they replied to us immediately and said that they would investigate the thing, they would look into it, and that they would let us know as soon as possible. Then we got the reply back, and it was really not a surprise to any of the four people that had signed the letter. And what they basically said is they found nothing in the agency's holdings to corroborate Mr. Brandon's specific claims. So basically, and then they referred to a 1997 study that they had done at the CIA, which reviewed 50 years of UFO involvement by the CIA, and basically came to the conclusion that the vast majority of UFO sightings were high-altitude spy planes that people had misidentified, and the same old story, there's really nothing to UFOs. So they basically came back, and that's what we figured they would do. They wouldn't say Brandon was a liar. They wouldn't say he was telling the truth. They just basically said, we looked, we couldn't find anything that confirmed what Mr. Brandon is saying. They didn't answer the question that we asked in terms of, what's your position on this? Did you talk to Mr. Brandon about this? Did you ask him where the files were? In fact, Billy Cox, who's a reporter from Florida, who was following the story, wrote a report on it, actually phoned and actually got a hold of the archivist at the Langley, in the archives at Langley, the headquarters, and he refused to talk. He said, the only thing I'm going to stand by the statement that was put out by the CIA. So basically what the CIA has done is what I think all the agencies have been doing for 50 years is they'll leak a story, they'll put it out, then they'll pull the story back, and then they'll go back to the company policy that UFOs aren't of national security importance. There's no threat. There's nothing extraterrestrial, and we aren't involved, and there's no cover-up. So that's basically what they did is they basically said, we have nothing. We can't. They didn't really deal with the response. They just said, we can't find the documents he's talking about. Didn't say whether they'd used him to help or anything, just basically used that, and now are standing tight in terms of making no further comment on what he said. And Brandon himself is sort of running for the hills. He did another coast-to-coast interview just a couple days ago. He did one with Britain. But what he told Lee Spiegel, and Lee Spiegel did the major article at the Huffington Post, and this is an article that has received 1.5 million hits. It's a massive viral article that's gone out there on Chase Brandon. And Lee Spiegel talked to him on Friday, and Chase Brandon is saying that now he's sort of screening the people that he does interviews with, and he's only going to talk to people who actually are going to want to talk about the book. He doesn't want to talk about the UFO part anymore. He just wants to talk about the book. And, of course, that avoids all the researchers who have the sort of tough questions as to, you know, the specifics of the story that he's telling.
Now, the CIA, when you contacted them, and your question was, can they verify, essentially, whether Chase Brandon was working for the CIA? What was their response to that question?
They didn't respond to anything. All they responded at the beginning was they said, we sent them a whole list of questions, six or seven questions, and all they stated in their initial reply was, we will look into the situation quickly, and we will get back to you. That's what they said. That was their only answer. And when they came with their final answer, they didn't answer any of the questions. All they said is they found nothing in the agency's holdings to corroborate Mr. Brandon's specific claims, the claims of the Roswell box. So they're basically saying, we couldn't find the documents. Didn't say where they had looked or who looked or whether they'd asked Brandon to help them. They just said, we can't find the documents, and really didn't refer to the coast-to-coast interview or anything, didn't address any of the questions, and now they're refusing to talk about anything. They just are saying, that's our statement, we're standing by the statement. And so that's what I've said they've done for years, is numerous agencies have done that, is they'll leak a UFO story, and then when the story starts to get move, they pull it back, and they just sort of leave it and say, we're not interested in UFOs, and whoever is telling the story ends up holding the story, whether it's Bob Lazar, or whether it's Corso, or all these people in history that have told these stories, and the story gets out, and the cover-up is maintained, which is, I think, what they're trying to do. They're leaking the story and keeping it under control by not really addressing the questions.
But there seems to be little doubt that Chase Brandon was, in fact, the CIA's liaison with the entertainment industry, correct?
Yeah. Robbie Graham has had correspondence with other CIA people, and they have basically confirmed that. And everybody that checked into Chase Brandon confirms that he was 25 years working as a covert agent, and then 10 years as the media guy. I don't think anybody denies that part of the story. That sort of holds up. He is who he says he is. It's in terms of how accurate his story is. And I think basically what's happened is he has gotten access to classified material through whatever means, by talking to people, by looking at documents or whatever. And because that's classified, he can't talk about that. So he's made up this story about this box that he found and has put out the story and now is sort of into a position where he's saying, I just believe Roswell happened, and we're going to leave it at that. And I believe that extraterrestrials have been here for thousands of years, and that's my belief, and what I saw in the box confirms my belief. And he's sort of, he doesn't want to talk about the specifics of this story that he initially told on Coast to Coast.
And so then what are we then to do with his statements originally, that he looked into this secret file, this box stamped Roswell, and saw artifacts and documents that he said corroborated all that we've ever heard about Roswell? What are we to do with this information now? Just dismiss it, forget it?
I think it just goes the same as the Lazar story or the Corso story or story like there's another CIA agent by the name of Ronald Pandolfi who leaks stuff through an intermediary, and he's told stories about the live alien at Los Alamos. And all these stories is what's happening. The story gets out and it sort of floats around. People sort of pick up on it, and then the actual core of the story falls apart. Like Chase Brandon will just sort of disappear. I've said I'm in contact with Lee Spiegel, who did the initial story, who's still in contact with Chase. He met with him for an hour last Friday, but Chase didn't want to do an interview, so they just sort of chit-chatted a little bit about this and that. And so I've said we've got to keep the guy talking. I don't think it really helps, because Chase Brandon is only a pawn in the game. I think unless you get the CIA to answer the questions as to who Chase Brandon is, whether they talked to Chase Brandon, whether they gave him instruction to do this, that's where the only place you're going to get any significant movement on the story. Chase Brandon, the story's not going to go anywhere, because he really can't, even himself, he says, I don't know what happened to the box, I don't know where it went, and so that part of the story just sort of fades away. He can't prove it, and we can't prove that he's lying, and that dies. It's the CIA, it's the agencies that are leaking this stuff, who are the agencies where they have the answers and they know what's going on, and they basically aren't talking. They have these sort of guys that sort of go out and spread this stuff, and it basically goes nowhere. It's like
it's frustrating.
They've done this for 40 years. They've done this kind of stuff.
Grant,
leak these stories, and it just disappears into nowhere. And that's what's going to happen here. The story will just eventually fade away.
All right, Grant. Well, thank you for the update. Grant Cameron, the website is www.presidentialufo.com. And, we'll follow it wherever it goes, I guess. That's the best we can do. But, Grant, thank you for the update.
On the website, I have quite a few updates. If you follow the website, I have almost daily an update of the story.
Terrific. Thank you for this. All right.
Thank you.
Nils Hamerun, End Times Prophecy, when we come back. Stay with us.
The owners of the system are asleep. Now we can play. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
I think most of us are aware that these unmanned drones, these unmanned flying vehicles are being used, widely used by the U.S. in Afghanistan to spot and target suspected insurgents and Taliban operatives in that country, as well as neighboring Pakistan. They've been used by American government agencies like U.S. Customs and Border Protection, a division of the Department of Homeland Security, for a few years in an observation surveillance capacity. But you may not be aware that earlier this year, Congress, with little fanfare, passed an FAA reauthorization bill, which President Obama signed into law, that makes it much easier for the government to put up to 30,000 of these unmanned spy planes or spy drones into American skies. We're going to discuss that in a few moments, along with this amazing story. A former police officer who retired from the FBI due to post-traumatic stress disorder linked to her role in the aftermath of September 11th terror attacks has recently written a book about seeing legions of angels guarding the Pennsylvania site where a hijacked airliner crashed. Lily Leonardi served as a liaison between law enforcement and the families of the passengers and crew members killed in the United Airlines Flight 93 crash. And she arrived on the scene about 3 hours after the crash. And now, according to her new book, In the Shadow of a Badge, a Spiritual Memoir, she talks about her vision of angels and argues her life has been changed by more by what she didn't see that day. We're going to delve into that right now with a biblical prophecy expert who's studied the Bible for nearly 60 years. He's the author of Seal of the End Times, and we're going to look at recent news events as seen through the prism of end times prophecy. A great pleasure to welcome back to the program Nils Hammerin. Nils, how are you, my friend?
I am fine, Richard, and it's great to be back on your show. You really have been doing a good job up there in Toronto, and we enjoyed getting the storm that you sent down to us just a few hours ago.
Did you get walloped by that? I described that as biblical earlier. That was just an Old Testament deluge.
There are very, very strange things going on in the New Jersey area with weather. We have had a storm appear out of nowhere with 1,000 lightning bolts in 15 minutes. That occurred about a week ago, and people are looking at these things and wondering, this is not normal. There are things going on that just don't make any sense. The whole country is a drought scene, and it just rains and rains in some places and no other place. There was a storm down in Florida that stayed in one place for 4 days, and it did not go into Texas, which needed rain badly.
You mentioned a drought, Nils, and I want to talk about this global food crisis that's looming and grain prices starting to soar. You mentioned the drought. They're saying that this is the worst drought in the United States in a quarter of a century.
That's right.
And this is giving rise to an old-fashioned commodity rally on world markets, but you're getting key grain prices hitting highs and causing food crises in vulnerable parts of the globe when we can least afford it. I mean, there's plenty of tinder around the world ready to be ignited. So this is all, you know, the last thing we need are food shortages and so forth. What can you tell me about what's going on with food prices and this drought?
Well, I would connect all of it to a basic problem. Whether or not people believe this or not, it's in the Bible, and I read it. I read it every day, and I say to myself, how simple it would be for us to make things better for the United States, for Canada, and for many parts of the world just by listening to the words in the Bible and doing what it is suggesting. And one of the things is that the Bible states that in our time, I mean, just looking at the time slice that we're living in right now, those people that ignore the Bible or ignore the plight of Israel are actually doing something which is bringing to themselves harm. If the United States would announce tomorrow that they're going to change their policy and back Israel to the hilt, the drought situation would ease within days. And all these strange things that are happening to crops, invasion into crop genetics by companies like Monsanto, government hoarding, government changing of things, all that would begin to be taken care of in a better way. Right now, the United States is thumbing its nose at the world, at prophecy, at religion. Religion is declining in the United States at a horrible rate. You can go past churches on a Sunday and see two cars outside of the church. And 3 years ago, the same church would have had maybe 25 cars or maybe more. Church attendance is declining. People are laughing at the words in the Bible. Religion is looked upon as some kind of a sickness. And people don't realize that we're being slowly coaxed into this position, even though it may not be something that we would on our own come to the conclusion that it was correct. And it is absolutely not correct. It's one of those things that you try to explain to people. The Bible is real. The Bible is very, very real. The thing is, too many people have taken Bible verses and made of them what they wanted. They're not reading the Bible as it states itself to be. And laying the groundwork for this sort of thing, you have to know about the Bible backwards and forwards, maybe spend a lot of time studying it. But there are key verses in the Bible that help us a great deal in understanding just what's taking place. Right now, in the time that the Antichrist will be in power, that is called Shabuah 350. It is the last block of prophecy time that we have available from the Bible. That means that we are in the end times. There's no question whether we're in the end times or not. If you know how the Shabuah clock works, which is God's clock, we have only one Shabuah block left. It hasn't started yet, but when it once starts, we even know the exact length of time that it will last, and that would be 6 years, 328 days. That's not a hard number to understand. And in fact, if you knew that number, and you knew when that Shabuah started, you would know the exact day that Armageddon would occur. In other words, you would know when the horrible times of the earth that is being plagued on us right now would end.
So some might say, though, you look around the world and we get back to this global food crisis, this 25-year or this drought that we're in. The breadbasket in the United States, the worst drought in 25 years. You've got corn prices that have, let me see here, they've surged 40% in the last 3 weeks alone.
That's right.
40% on corn prices. What is it in the end times? What does it say about what's going to happen to food supplies? I mean,
there will be droughts. And there are not only droughts, any drought is definitely going to cause a food shortage. We're having a surge in the world population, which is not being met by new farms. In fact, I can read in New Jersey magazines that cover New Jersey, which is not really a farm state, but we're losing farms at a high rate. It's small farms. They may not be big farms, but every year we lose farms. We don't gain any farms. We don't gain any food. All that has been shifted out to the Midwest, and now big companies are running the show the way they want. Maybe they want high prices. Maybe they want a food shortage. That is the illogical way that some of these people think. They want war.
It says this recent surge in grain prices has added 75 million people to the number of chronically hungry people in the world. Other estimates put that increase up to 160 million additional chronically hungry people. Nils Hamren is with us, End Times Press, author of Seal of the End Times. The other story I wanted to get to, Nils, has to do with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. They're now apparently calling U.S. households and demanding child immunization records as part of a vaccine surveillance and tracking program. I mean, I don't care what side of the vaccine issue on. That's just, to me, that's just, that's invasive. That's wrong.
Absolutely. And it's increasing in something like this actually is a bellwether. When something like this happens, you know that the republic, which the United States is in serious trouble, simply because a government agency thinks it has the right to call people and demand that their children are immunized, whether or not the immunizations work, and many scientists state clearly they don't work, and in fact they can be very dangerous. A certain percentage of people that get these shots wind up dead, and there are other people that take the shots. Of course, they don't benefit at all from what the shot's supposed to help them with. In fact, it may actually create the disease that it's supposed to be against, such as the flu vaccine.
A letter from the CDC, or they're getting they get a letter, and it says, your phone number was chosen randomly by computer, explains the letter, which goes on to say that the CDC will use your information to generate a map of vaccine compliance, no doubt to later target low compliance areas with increased vaccination propaganda or even court-ordered immunization mandates, like the one that was witnessed in Maryland not too long ago, where people were actually told to show up at the county courthouse with their children in tow, and they were vaccinated by basically by force. They couldn't leave without getting their children vaccinated. Now, hard to believe this is all happening in the land of the brave and the land of the free.
It's also hard to believe that people are becoming mentally off kilter. Little children are getting these immunizations, and they turn into people that are not fully formed. They have problems, mental problems. So this is linked to injections of these common diseases that the government is pushing. And scientists analyzed the fluid that's in some of these injections. It turns out there's mercury, there's aluminum, there's all kinds of things that in the human body have no purpose whatsoever.
But how does this, how do you see this child immunization, the tracking, surveilling and tracking vaccine programs and the immunization of children, how do you see this as playing into biblical end times prophecy?
It is government increasing its control of the individual. In other words, the human right to free will is being challenged by governments and other types of forms of control of people. It's something which is ungodly. A human being is born with a brain, and we're supposed to make our own decisions, our own, path out our own life the way we want to do it, and form our own ideas of the right moral codes and so forth. And we can only do that if we have free will.
All right.
Now, what happens when the government intrudes on you like this, the natural reaction in most people is to back off and let others decide. Let the government do what they want and so forth. And that way, you're losing your free will.
Okay, Nils, got to take a timeout. When we come back, we'll talk about this ex-FBI agent claiming she saw angels guarding the Flight 93 site. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Nils Hamron, End Times Press. Stay with us.
Where the truth often hides. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Nils Hamron is with us from End Times Press, and the book is Seal of the End Times. We'll tell you how to get a copy of that. First, I just wanted to go back to a story I touched on earlier, and we like to think of the drone war as something sort of far away. being fought in the deserts of Yemen or the mountains of Afghanistan, but it's a lot closer than many of us are aware. There are 64 drone bases on American soil. These are these unmanned aerial vehicles, and they are, well, in many cases, in Afghanistan, they are armed and they are being used to target insurgents and Taliban and terrorists and so forth. But these bases in the U.S., you've got a predator, the Predator, you've got the Reaper, you've got medium-sized drones called the Shadow. They're in about 22 different bases. There's something even smaller called the Raven. There's a miniature one called the Wasp in 11 California and Texas bases. Now, according to the Posse Comitatus Act, that prohibits the U.S. military from operating on American soil, which means that these drones couldn't be used against U.S. citizens. There's no evidence that drones have violated that so far. But I got to believe you know it's coming. I mean, I think it's a fine line between, you know, using an unmanned drone on a citizen and merely spying on a citizen. And then, of course, we have the story of the U.S. Congress okaying 30,000 flying drones to be used perhaps on Americans across U.S. cities. Nils Hamren, what do you make of this disturbing trend, the use of drones?
It's a very interesting double-sided kind of a story, because they made the 30,000 flying drones are actually 30,000 licenses. In other words, you have to have a license if you're going to fly a drone, because there are private companies that want to do this. There are companies that do logging and they do aerial surveying and so forth. A drone is a perfect way for them to do some of this work. And then there's the argument that on the coasts of both, well, even on large lakes, when there's a distress call, it takes time for boats, even airplanes, to get over to the site where the distress call is coming from. A drone could get out there very quickly and could be programmed to cover an area just automatically, and that is what some of these license applications are reading out. They're also saying that in U.S., government parks, there is a constant need for people to go out, especially in bad weather and in complete dark and so forth. And I believe these drones can operate, some of the drones can operate in the dark, looking for lost hikers, campers, people like that.
Well, that's an excellent point. Yeah, so in other words, the approval for 30,000 flying drones is basically they're going to license 30,000, and these may be private ventures. They may be used for search and rescue, so there's an upside. These can
that's
be very
the
useful.
The downside would be exactly what you were inferring in the beginning, that they can become spy tools. And that is, you know, where you have to draw the line. If they're being used humanely, so be it. If they're being used to cause trouble, to spy on people, find out what's going on, let's say, on a large farm, spy on if there's drugs coming in there or something that they want to track, guns are coming in, or they could use them on the borderline, you know, with Mexico. Trying to keep an eye, and let's say a continuous eye, on who is coming across and where are they going. That might be a way of setting up a patrol of our borders in a fairly inexpensive way. If it's looked in that regard, I don't think the drones are a bad thing. But once it goes bad, how do you counter it? What are you going to do? Get aircraft weapons that can shoot down a drone?
Well, again, let's put this through the end times filter, and we'll do that when we come back after the break. How these drones might be used? Suppose, let's say, during the reign of the Antichrist. We'll also talk about a former Pentagon analyst who says China can shut down all the telecom gear it's sold to the U.S. There's a daunting thought, and we'll discuss that and more with End Times Prophecy expert Nils Hamren will also take your calls. Back with more in a minute here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett.
Providing the evidence and letting you draw your own conclusions. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
So much to discuss, so little time. Nils Hamren here with End Times Press, the author of Seal of the End Times. We may have to institute this as a semi-regular feature as we examine news events through the filter of biblical prophecy. Nils, I do want to eventually get around to, time permitting, you have a very interesting theory as to what might be behind the UFO phenomena. We just heard recently from, or earlier from, Grant Cameron talking about a former CIA official who stated publicly that everything we've heard about Roswell, the UFO crash there in 1947, is absolutely true, including the recovery of alien cadavers. But first, I want to get your take on a former Pentagon analyst saying that China has the covert capability to remotely access communications technology sold to the United States and other Western countries by China, that they've got sort of a back door almost into computers, systems, and so forth at the Pentagon.
Right. Richard, this particular story really bothers me, because you say to yourself, the Pentagon has all these geniuses working there, and here they are buying chips for highly costly weaponry, airplanes. The X-15, for instance, cannot fly without chips. And why would they buy chips from China, which they did? And now the X-15 planes are all grounded until the chips are replaced. That is going to take up to 3 years. They have supplied the chips that we are using in our ICBMs, all kinds of air-to-air missiles, all these things that have to have a chip in them to steer them or to maneuver them or receive signals. They're all coming from China. But the other side of the question is, in order to make these chips, you need pure silicone. And China is hogging all kinds of strategic materials in such a way that eventually, unless you kowtow to them, you will not be able to build some of the things you would like to build or do projects you'd like to be involved in. The X-15, as far as I know, is still grounded.
So the idea here is that we have, for example, these Chinese telecommunication firms such as ZTE Corp. They've got these electronic back doors to the telecommunications technology that they sold to the U.S. and, I don't know, maybe even Canada.
That's correct. They have the X-35, which has been on the drawing boards for years, has become increasingly difficult to engineer and to even to produce. I don't believe one of them was ever produced. It's still on the drawing boards. And now the last I heard was the whole project was canceled simply because it requires so many chips. And the only way that they can get these chips is through China. And the only reason I can think of that is we don't have clear, pure silicone. If you use silicone with impurities in it, you wind up with an uncontrollable product. So
what's worst case scenario? I mean, there were rumors during the Bush administration that Dick Cheney was aboard. I'm not sure if it was Air Force One, but whatever the vice president flies around in.
He was flying from Australia to the U.S.
And what happened?
First, the lights went out in the main cabin. Then all TV sets and so forth went out. The bathrooms, I think, went out. And Cheney was in there, and the plane's navigational system was compromised. And they received a message to follow a certain area of the Pacific. They were flying in the Pacific at that point, to turn and to take up a certain azimuth, which they did. And they were directed to land in a Chinese city. And when they did that, Cheney came out of the airplane ranting and raving, you know, what's going on here and so forth, and screaming at the top of his lungs. And the Chinese met him there on the runway and said, we brought your plane here with our computers. And he didn't know what to say. And then they told him that we have control of your weapons, we have control of your airplanes, we have control of your radar, and so forth. And this is proof to you that we have this. He got back in the plane, and he was allowed to fly back. They took away the controls of the plane and returned everything to normal. And very little ever really was put in the press about it. But it was a direct control of a U.S. aircraft, highly selected, and a plane that normally you would think would be, it was U.S. Air Force One.
And obviously sending a not-so-subtle message as to who's really running the show and who's in control.
Right, and the Chinese really were not threatening. They were just saying, we are controlling this. You are not controlling this. And in a way, it was like saying they're taking away power from the United States, and they're going to run the show, and we're not going to run the show. And if you want chips from us, pay us and just shut up.
All right. I want to move on to the statement by a recent, well, it's a book, actually, by a former police officer. She retired from the FBI due to post-traumatic stress disorder, which was linked to her role in the aftermath of the September 11th terror attacks. And she's written a book claiming that she saw legions of angels guarding the Pennsylvania site where a hijacked airliner crashed. This is Lily Leonardi. Now, Nils, you have been dealing with the spiritual world and spiritual matters for close to six decades. Have you heard similar stories, or is this a trend?
Not only stories. I mean, I can tell my own stories. I have three angels that I have seen in my lifetime. And one time I saw an angel in the parking lot at GM because I was supposed to report to work late and not when the shift started. So when I got to the parking lot, there was no activity. There was nobody in the area. And I pulled into the parking lot, and I found a place to park right by the front gate. And that was great. So I swung the van around, and I'm backing into the one parking space there. And I see this girl walking by the place where I just drove in. And I couldn't understand how she could be walking there because I just came through there, and the whole street for about a half mile in both directions is completely fenced in. So I parked and I got out of the van and I began walking in that direction. I realized this woman, she was very pretty and she was wearing a sweater of a certain design. And but below her hips, there was no body. She was walking on legs that were totally invisible. That's how I knew that she was an angel. And it did not scare me. It did not flip me out or anything like that. I have seen too much. So I just knew it was an angel, but I didn't know what it was going to lead to. And I got to the gate, and she had passed a pillar that was part of the gate, and momentarily I didn't see her. And then I looked up and down the street, again, half a mile both ways, nobody in sight. She had disappeared. The next day in a New York paper, there was an advertisement for a sweater exactly the same as she was wearing. And I decided there must be a reason, there's a connection of some kind here. So I called up the company that had the sweater, and the company's name was the same as my wife. And I asked about the sweater, and I told her, yeah, we have it in different sizes, and I bought one. And my wife wore it for angel protection for many weeks. And we don't know if it actually gave her protection or not, but I did follow through on what happened with that. So angels to me are not new. And I've seen other angels, one in a gas station and one somewhere else came into a place I had as a business and told me about my end days, what I would be like when I was older.
What do you make of Lily Leonardi's story, this former FBI agent?
I think it's a great story, and I think that, you know, she's a very honest person. The book she wrote, I think, is worth reading because it's just something. Here she is, an ex-FBI person trained to go to a crash site or to go to a place where there's trouble and evaluate things quickly. And she gets there 3 hours after the crash. There are no bodies, and there's practically no airplane. So what probably crashed there was a drone. And probably the same thing happened at the Pentagon. Again, no bodies. No, a drone was probably the one that went in there and blew up so that people would think it was an airplane.
But particularly, what do you make of her report that she saw a legion of angels guarding? I mean, it would hard to imagine why angels would guard a drone had it been had it crashed. But she saw angels guarding the Flight 93 crash site. What do you make of that claim?
To me, it's an uplifting kind of a report because angels are very helpful. They try to be helpful. There's several kinds of angels. Angels you don't want to mess with are the cherubim angels. They are the holy wing of Jehovah's military, and there are plenty of those right here on the earth right now. I talk to a person on the phone at times, and that person claims to be an angel in human form. And being an angel, she said, believe it or not, it's very hard being on the earth because the pollution really gets to you. And if you're on the earth, you have to get off of it pretty quick. You can't stay around. And she said that angels have like contracts. They'll only come to the earth if it's just 30 days or 60 days. Because of the pollution. The air is so horrible for them. And these angels that were seen in Pennsylvania, isn't it interesting that you see angels and you see no airplane?
Hmm. Indeed, indeed. You had an interesting theory as to how angels may, in fact, be connected to the UFO phenomenon.
Well, that is quite a story, and what I would like to do quickly, I'll take maybe 30 seconds just to give my background so people don't think I'm a total nut. Many, many years ago, in the late 50s, I was working for NASA, and my capacity was I was working in the design engineering area, and I had my own small department. One of the responsibilities we had, we were working on the X-15 rocket engine. And my responsibility was to supply numbers and also parts lists and centers of gravity of the engines. There were several engines. We had test engines and we had production engines. It was Project 24. And while I was doing all this, everybody in the engineering field, you know, had time to spare because of slow work and so forth. And they would try little games like how much is the gravity force between the Earth and the Sun. And they would use their computers and figure out what it would take to put a cable there and take up the load that was being done by gravity. And they found out it would take a stainless steel cable 300 miles in diameter to hold the Earth in place and not take off from the Sun. And there's no place to put this cable. So basically we studied things about space travel. We studied trajectories. How do you get from this planet to another planet? How can you use a planet as a sling? What are the possibilities of ETs coming here to this planet? And if they did come here, what would they do? And the present ideas of ETs are really unsustainable once you find out how far the nearest planets really are. An ET in a homemade rocket ship of some type would never make it. The ET would have to be in something that was utilizing some kind of space hole, some kind of a way of overcoming distance rapidly. And that would be at the level of practically angels. So the next question is, are these UFOs that we're watching coming into this area of the planet, are they UFOs? And if they are UFOs, why are they here? Who's in them? Why are they not landing? Why don't they talk to somebody? Why don't they shoot at somebody if they're evil? And the truth of the matter is, even if a U.S. fighter fires at a UFO, nothing happens. The UFO is not in any way threatened.
So because we're running short on time, Nils, your theory is that these UFOs are piloted by what?
They're piloted by four cherubim angels. They are the holy arm of Jehovah. And he is getting ready to bear the holy arm, which he has done in the past. Bearing the holy arm means that the angels become visible and active. And right now, there have been so many sightings of UFOs coming into the Jerusalem area. They come down at night. And sometimes visitors to Jerusalem wait up and until they get to the low hours in the morning. And lo and behold, here comes a UFO down right on the Temple Mount, just about 150 feet in the air. Flashes a light or just leaves a bright light on and then takes off. And it only stays in the area a short time. But the thing is, why do they keep coming down to the Temple Mount? They have some kind of an interest in that as a, let's say, a site that they would use to know distances, to, let's say, map out the borders of Israel. But there's no question that we are heading into World War III. And World War III involves a major, major invasion of Israel, and it is stopped by the cherubim angels.
All right, Nils, got to cut it there, but we'll pick it up again. Appreciate it. Quickly, how do people get a hold of Seal of the End Times?
Well, they could call us at 908-725-6252, and we'll be glad to ship them a copy. And that will come with updates so they know just what's going on in the recent times.
908-725-6252. Nils, great talking to you again. We'll do it again soon.
Same here. Great show.
Nils Hamerin. All right, back next week with Marie Jones. A journey through portals, relativity, wormholes, and other adventures in time travel. Check it out. And the website, of course, www.richardserrett.com. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, nothing hidden that won't be made known. What I say in the dark, speak in the light, what you hear in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite, I'm coming home. Good night.